This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Corey Rosenbusch, President and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with TFI's Corey Rosenbusch next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 530 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. High input prices are pushing many crop farmers deeper and deeper into red ink. The USDA and the Department of Justice investigating the source of those price increases. And just this past week, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on input costs. Corey Rosenbusch, President and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute, says nutrient prices have gone from record lows to historic highs in just a short time. Most of the jump is out of their control.
The roller coaster is a great way to describe it. You know, we all remember 21 and 22 when we saw 300% increases. That was all those black swan events we were talking about after. Oh goodness, I don't know the exact period, but a long period of record lows. And as in anything in agriculture, it's cyclical. And so there are years where we all lose money and years where we make money, and you hope that it just balances out over time. We were coming down to what I would call, 10-year average, right? Even with the 10-year average following 2022. And then here we go again. And so, you know, we probably had a year or two break in there, and then now we get into 2025 and we're starting to see those go up again. Why does it matter? Because particularly, let me reference a small retailer that may not have a strong balance sheet or a lot of capital. You know, they're going to buy into the market. They're going to take inventory at a certain price. And so If that market's bumping around, they could quickly be long, and have to write off millions of dollars like we saw in 2008 and 2009. And so that yo-yo of up and down and back and forth, it's not good for anybody in the fertilizer industry either, including the grower.
How much does the U.S. produce compared to the rest of the globe? And are we an exporter or an importer?
So we're only 7% of total production. And I think, you know, we look at how abundant our crops are, and we just have to assume that we must be, you know, equally as dominant on the production fertilizer side. And the reality is we're not. We're a net importer. We have to, particularly when you think about potash and even phosphate. I mean, one of the things that came up in the Judiciary Committee hearing over and over again was the concentration of U.S. producers. But if I use phosphate as an example, you can't use the word percentage of market because U.S. is only 60% of the total market. So 40% is imported. So therefore that gets skewed. You're really only talking about a little over half of the market of being U.S. producers. So sometimes when people think about concentration, they have to think about it truly as the market, meaning total need of the U.S. farmer, not just in the U.S. silo of production. So with that amount, we are a net importer. We have to rely on these global supply chains. There are things that we can do to affect supply domestically, and at the end of the day, who those trading partners are matter.
Corey, when we say fertilizer, that's not one thing. There are many components to crop nutrients. And of course, if you don't feed the crop, you don't raise the crop.
Yeah, they're all very different, and they're all very different markets, and they're dramatically different, and how they're produced is dramatically different. And you have to take them each one by one. And to your point, it gets kind of lumped into as a fertilizer. So if we start with nitrogen, maybe start there. We are very competitive from a nitrogen perspective. We have over 18 different producers of nitrogen in this country. We still are an importer of about a third of our nitrogen, just because, you know, we have so much need for it, but there are a lot of global producers of nitrogen, and there are many different types of nitrogen. So, because of our natural gas, supply, we can compete, really efficiently and effectively from a nitrogen production standpoint. But there's also these plants, these ammonia plants, you can't just turn them on and turn them off. You can't dial them up and dial them back. Once they're operating at capacity, they are a constant, I think about the old I Love Lucy show, right, where the chocolate's just coming off the factory line there and it's got to go somewhere. So when we're in a season where we're not a big user of, say, urea or UAN, then we need to find a place for that to go, and that's going to be elsewhere in the world that is perhaps in the global south that is in a different planting or use cycle. So we do end up exporting some of our fertilizer product just because of that dynamic around the supply chain. On the phosphate and potash side, I say all the time that is where God put it on the earth, and you cannot. The economist who was on the panel with me talked about the four firm concentration of potash being at 100%. Well, that's because we do not have abundant potash reserves in the United States. We import 98% of it. So you have to truly think about that as a market and not just a U.S. production.
When we talk about global fertilizer production, who are the global players? And what role has the geopolitical element of this price discovery? What role has that played into available supply and price?
Well, I would start with China. So China is our largest producer. President Trump just came back from China, so we're very aware of how they like to use policies to impact things like food security. And when you're producing a third of all of the world's nitrogen and you have 40% of the global phosphates and you say, we're not going to allow any exports of that, we're just going to keep it home domestically for our own farmers or maybe for our own lithium phosphate batteries that we're producing for this EV movement, whatever the motivation is from the Chinese government, that impacts the price the farmer pays here. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but if you wanted to think about where to point fingers, I'd say it's not at our U.S. producers who do want to see a farmer successful. We need the farmer to be successful. You have to think about how these foreign governments may be manipulating their own production and policy to affect global food security and food production. A lot of that product would go to India. India is the second largest consumer of fertilizer. Their central government procures it all as one purchase, heavily then subsidizes it for their own grower. If they can't get those Chinese tons, they're then having to go out to the global market, and so they're grabbing tons that might be destined for the United States or for Indonesia or for Argentina, and so that drives up a premium that they're paying to then substitute that because China's no longer on the market. One of my favorite questions I asked somebody the other day was, who can tell me this? If Russia is the largest exporter, which they are, they're the largest supplier of fertilizer to the world, who is the second largest urea exporter in the world? And the answer is Iran. And it shocks everyone because you don't really think about Iran's participation in agriculture. But when those nuclear facilities got bombed, it affected their nitrogen production. And so that took 11% of global nitrogen off the marketplace. So somebody's now going to pay a premium and compete for those tons elsewhere. We're talking about countries that control and almost half of the fertilizer produced in this world gets exported. And you're talking about countries that are controlling production and policies around where this movement moving being China, Russia, Belarus, Iran, heavily concentration in the Middle East.
So if we go back to the hearing on Tuesday, it was Senator Durbin who said of his farmers, you're killing them with high fertilizer prices. Corey, it's easy to point fingers in a situation like this, but from the farmer side of the equation, they're caught in a bind here. So what bind are you caught in, or what has driven us to these points that farmers are facing now?
Our growers are in a really tough situation. Their commodity prices are low and their input costs are growing. And in some ways, we are also a commodity that are also price takers. So when Europe has to shutter 70% of their ammonia plants because they can't get natural gas from Russia anymore, they suddenly become the marginal producer. So Europe ammonia tons then become the base price for the whole world to trade on. And so in that way, we're price takers as well, because that price is being set elsewhere by foreign policy decisions, in that case, natural gas coming in from Russia. There is, and I said this in my testimony, because we are a globally traded commodity, there's very little we can do to just simply affect or change price. Because you can compare these prices and they're similar all over the world. So our only real option is to do things to bolster supply, because it's supply and demand driven. And so that's really, I think, the objective of so many of the policy recommendations we were making, was to look at things to bolster supply. Unfortunately, those don't happen overnight. So I feel dearly for the growers who are in a short-term real pickle until we figure out long-term adjustments to affect supply.
So let's talk about policy. Fertilizer Institute, you've called for some things. You're looking for some practical solutions. You want to expand markets for growers so they can get a better price for their commodity, and also to be sure that they have the nutrients they need when they need them. What are you asking short-term and long-term for Washington to consider?
Well, I think it's exactly that. It's some things that will allow U.S. Supply to flourish, to make sure we have tons that are available to those growers. I'll use phosphate for an example, and I know that's a tricky one. Saudi Arabia is our largest foreign supplier of phosphate. I mentioned we import about 40% of our phosphates. 38% of that comes from Saudi Arabia. We haven't seen vessels, imports are down. We haven't seen vessels, arrive here, since April 1 due to some of the uncertainty around the tariffs. And so, you know, what we would like to say is we do have phosphate reserves here. There are opportunities to grow domestic production. And so what we'd like to see is permitting streamlined. So these are all mined minerals. So in the case of phosphate, often it's a strip mine across the top. And to get those permits can take a decade sometimes. We'd also like to see designation as phosphate and potash as critical minerals, because that would help with some of the permitting and also the regulatory burden that they face. I think one of the things that makes phosphate production, I think one of the things that affects competitiveness on a global scale for U.S. phosphate producers are the regulatory burden. So let's take phosphogypsum. It's my favorite word to say. It's the byproduct of producing phosphate. And by the way, I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize you don't just take the phosphate rock, crush it up, and then throw it on the ground. It's not available to the plant in that way. So it has to be manufactured by creating sulfuric acid. Price of sulfur is way up. And then combined with ammonia to create the MAP and the DAP. Prices for ammonia are up. So when you think about what drives phosphate, they have input costs into that production that's also affecting things. But every ton of MAP or DAP that we produce, we get 5 tons of this phosphogypsum. 51 countries around the world are allowed to reutilize that phosphogypsum in a circular economy way whether that's for construction projects or, frankly, for soil amendments. Brazil uses it as a soil amendment because there's still nutrient content in that product to help the grower. We have to stack it in 100 feet high mountains all across Florida and spend about $1 billion a year to maintain each of those stacks because our regulatory system does not allow for reuse of that material. Even though science and even EPA career staff have done risk assessments to say that it's safe to be utilized. So all of those extra costs, you know, just make the competitiveness of U.S. phosphate more and more challenging.
How would a position at the USDA on fertilizer help to expose the situation or the status of the industry?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. And we've been working on this for a number of years now. Our former economist, Harry Vrooman, before we hired him, he actually was at USDA as a dedicated economist focused on fertilizer. And that was over 20 years ago that position existed. And as you can hear, it is a complicated market. The supply and demand and geopolitical factors, and we didn't even talk about what's driving demand up for fertilizer outside of the United States, but we've seen demand go up. It's difficult to understand. And so when you think about the trusted advisor of a farmer being the retail agronomist, retail agronomists are often making crop nutrient recommendations, planting recommendations. They're not explaining the economics of supply and demand in between Russia, China, and India. We can appreciate that it's hard for a farmer to get good information, to understand what's going on in the market, to understand what is a Brazilian farmer paying for MAP and DAP versus a U.S. farmer. And how do we compare and reconcile all these? And sure, we can explain it. Yes, there are private companies out there that are explaining it. But we just think having an independent voice, a trusted and independent voice, such as the United States Department of Agriculture, to add some visibility, some transparency, and some information to growers to help them make decisions is good for everyone. Because after all, we're all in this together. So that's something we've been promoting for a long time. Senator Grassley has a bill in the Senate that would look at studying markets. You know, we understand that. We studied it. Iowa State just did a huge study on it 2 years ago. We want a permanent solution to support kind of Grassley's vision there by having that position available at USDA.
Well, there is the supply and there is the demand. And in terms of demand, one of the stories in agriculture ongoing is the expansion of production in Brazil. And we've also seen expansion of acres or hectares for that matter in other places of the globe as well. Is this affecting demand for fertilizer and price?
One of the things on the demand side that, that I mentioned to the Judiciary Committee is that, there are crops around the world that are seeing a surge in commodity prices right now that thus demand more fertilizer. Those crops would be palm oil and canola and rubber and coffee. None of those are grown in the United States. And so those countries that are, you know, demanding more of that fertilizer product because they are seeing a bump in crop are affecting the prices that a grower would pay here. And yes, the more that the Brazilian farmer intends to produce and have markets to go to, the more they're going to require products. And one of the other things I mentioned in my testimony is even with the prices, we still saw what, Jeff, 8 million additional acres of planted corn this year. That demanded more fertilizer as well. So, you know, on the demand side, there's also an increase, which if you have an environment where you have increased demand, and we have significant supply shortages in the world for fertilizer, that's going to create the storm we're in.
Why were companies, or how did the economics of scale make it so that consolidation would take place in this industry?
Well, I think some of it's capital, right? So when you're talking about a nitrogen plant that costs $5 billion to build, when you're talking about a phosphate mine that may cost $35 million just to get permitted. Those are economies of scale that tend to lead towards consolidation, tend to lead towards having larger scale in order to get that return on capital. So I think those are some of the efficiencies that are required. I think, without getting into the details, a nitrogen plant that was recently acquired was done so because it wasn't operating efficiently and then just didn't have the resources within that company because it was one of several operations that they were looking at. And so if another company can take it over and run it more efficiently, ultimately at the end of the day, that means more supply here in the United States. In addition to the capital that's required, our U.S. producers also need to be able to compete with state-owned enterprises. In a lot of these countries, the producer there is a state-owned enterprise, and so there aren't multiple companies that exist to produce the fertilizer in those countries. Matter of fact, we're only one of three countries in the world that have 20 unique companies producing fertilizer. So you get into some of these areas, and it is the one state-owned enterprise, and it is driven by what the government wants out of that enterprise. So that's the other thing that's driven, some of the competitiveness factors that we see in the United States on a global level.
So, Corey, we concentrate in agriculture, obviously, on the issues of today. The dust has just barely settled now on the National FFA Convention in Indianapolis. You spent some time there. So let's think out loud to what agriculture looks like for this next generation. What are the responsibilities before our government, before our industry today, to maintain a foundation for this next generation who will produce the food, the fiber, and the fuel for the globe?
Well, Jeff, I will tell you, after starting the week in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, what was a very challenging perhaps couple of days, there was no better way to end the week than at the National FFA Convention, because if there is one thing that gives you optimism about the future of agriculture and, frankly, the future of this country, it are these young people, 70,000 young people that were in Indianapolis this week. And I had a chance to talk to several of them, and it's great that they have their eyes on policy, that this is part of what they are learning about and talking about. I listened to the extemporaneous public speaking finalists, and they were clearly referencing policy and policymakers, and hopefully those are our future leaders that are going to be very in tune to what that looks like. And of course, we have a former FFA alumni that's doing just that at the Department of Agriculture.
Well, Corey Rosenbusch, we want to thank you very much for taking time out of a monster busy schedule to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. It is Open Mic, Corey, and today you get the last word.
Well, Jeff, I think you nailed it. There's a tendency whenever we get into a difficult situation to want to cast blame, and there is no doubt that farmers right now are going through a really tough time, and even within the input space, we are all in this together, and not just in this together from retailers and importers and manufacturers, but in it together, in that at the end of the day, we need a farmer to be successful, because without a grower, none of this industry would exist.
Our thanks to Corey Rosenbusch, President and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.